Rabbi Strauchler, thank you very much, as I thanked you last night, for hosting this Shavuaton in lieu of our usual spring Shabbaton, and for all of your help and guidance during this terrible time. I also want to thank Meital in the Shaar Shemayim office for all of her help in making this program possible. I also want to make sure to call everyone's attention to the Shavuaton programs that we have planned for the rest of the week, with sessions each evening on Tuesday and Thursday. It will be after Maariv in this time slot. On Wednesday will be in the time slot of Rabbi Bergman's usual session at 7:30. And the program culminates with a drasha before Kabbalat Shabbat on Friday, all related to different aspects of the pandemic. The Shavuaton, as Rabbi Strauchler mentioned, is dedicated by Judy Laxer and Jeff Lipsitz and family in loving memory of Judy's father, Carl Laxer, Yekutiel Chaim ben Avram Vitova Zichrona Levracha, and actually discovered the other day in a Zoom Shiva visit with Judy and Jeff that I have a family connection that I was not aware of. But apparently my uncle, Jim Torchiner, held Mr. Laxer, held Carl Laxer in very high esteem. And I had a chance after the Shiva to talk to my uncle about it, and really he had the most beautiful and moving things to say about him. So that was unexpected and for me very, very moving. I have a source sheet for the program this evening, and I emailed it to Rabbi Strauchler in the hope that he would be able to post it in the chat.
In the process.
Okay. So while the source sheet is processing, I only sent it to him 5 minutes ago. So the fault is definitely with me. But I'll introduce our topic. Are unproven medicines kosher? This is an extremely hard question. This is a question which exists, of course, far beyond the circumstances of the pandemic. It relates to issues of alternative medicine and alternative therapies. It relates to how we practice medicine at all, but it becomes particularly challenging in the era of COVID-19. Number one, because on the side of public health, Rabbi Strauchler? It looks like you cut and pasted it into the chat. I was hoping you could just post it as a file.
Okay, I'll try it.
Yeah, see if that works. If not, I'll just share my screen and we'll work with that. But the challenges of this time in particular. On the one hand, you have the argument of public health, which says that it's not safe to start loosing treatments on the public until those treatments have been tested and demonstrated to be safe, let alone to work. And we have certain protocols which are well established for how you do trials. You have phase one where you determine the safety, and then you go on to phase two and phase three. And that should be honored, even and perhaps especially in a time like this, when people are drawn through desperation to treatments that could be very dangerous and that could be harmful even beyond the patients themselves. You know, obviously one example of this is the discussion of hydroxychloroquine, which not only is a question of whether it's effective in its own right, but that it is needed for people with lupus. It is needed for people with rheumatoid arthritis, and the concern that if people are going to use it off-label, then those who need it on-label may not have it when they need it. On the other hand, the argument that pandemic is unique. This isn't a time for standing on ceremony and insisting on protocol. If you could save lives, then take the risks, make the move, and pray for the best. The circumstance is particularly difficult for doctors who find themselves dealing with families who have heard about treatments elsewhere. And this is something that that doctors talk about all the time. The idea of Dr. Google. Rabbis have Rabbi Google. in which people come to them and say, I saw on the internet that it's really okay to whatever, that this is actually kosher. Well, doctors have it much worse, because everybody on the internet is an expert in practicing medicine. And so I saw this cure, I saw this therapy, I saw this vaccine, and so on and so forth. And particularly because, thank God, through the networks that Jews have to their relatives elsewhere and to Jews in other communities, we're all in touch with people who are dealing with the same crisis that we're facing here. Often, a doctor will have a patient here, and the family of the patient will say, well, why aren't you trying X? I know that in New York, they're using this. I know that in California, they're using this. I know that in Israel, they're using this. And the doctor has to answer to the family as to why they're not saving the life of the patient using this definitely life-saving treatment, definitely life-saving in the eyes of the patient's family. So this becomes really a challenging and heart-wrenching question. I'm not going to get into the specifics of which medicines and which treatments, because that's just a never-ending rabbit hole. However, I did have a special request from a doctor who participates in my medical programs, Dr. Pupko, asked me to post the link, which I am going to post, because I think it's a perfect illustration of what we're talking about. So I'm putting it in the chat for those who wish to follow up on it. It's regarding melatonin as a potential treatment that some are suggesting, and that is actually, I think, entering a clinical trial, if I understood his email correctly. It's an example of one of these types of treatments. If you take a look at the source sheet, the source sheet's not in the chat yet. So what I'm going to do is call it up on my computer, and I will just share it that way rather than wrestle with the chat, because I'm having my own problems trying to upload things to the chat. So in a moment, I will be able to open it and put it on your screen, and then we'll be able to work from there. But the articles that I put in that I put up on the website that I know Rabbi Strauchler emailed out, I think also illustrates some of the challenges that we are talking about in this situation. One was an article from the New York Times. There, everyone should now be able to see this on their screen. Okay. So if you take a look at the top there, you see the two links. One for an article from the New York Times, touting virus cure, simple country doctor becomes a right-wing star. Dr. Zelenko from outside of Muncie, and his touting of a combination of hydroxychloroquine with azithromycin. And then an article from 2003 by Rabbi J. David Bleich on what he calls hazardous medical procedures. So these are old issues, as I said. These are issues that extend far beyond the pandemic. And they create real emotional as well as intellectual challenges in trying to take care of patients. I also gave you there, you see it on the sheet, links for three classes that I've taught in the community before, audio recordings that are on YU Torah, where you can get background information on related topics, one being vaccinations and the issue of potentially harmful treatments, but on the other hand, life-saving. Second, the issue of accepting or rejecting medical advice. And third, the issue of patient autonomy and informed consent. So those are also useful, and I believe they did go out in the shul email this morning. I think I gave this source sheet for that email this morning. If not, perhaps it'll go out in tomorrow morning's email from Shari Shemayim. But let's get to the sources and see what we can do to address this now that we've spent a couple of minutes on background. Okay, I want to tackle this first from the perspective of the medical professional and talk through the medical professional's decision of whether to pursue such a treatment or not, and then to use some time at the end to talk about it from the patient's perspective. The patient's perspective is a lot easier in halacha than the medical professional's perspective, as you'll see. But from the medical professional's perspective, I have a patient, I am not me, I am not a doctor, I'm not pretending to be one, a medical professional, a doctor, a nurse, whatever, has a patient they are responsible to take care of. The patient presents with symptoms. Let's say we're talking about a COVID-19 case, since that's the case at hand. The patient's cousin says that, I need to stop sharing for a moment. Sorry. My audio is doing the same thing it did last night, and now it comes back. Okay. The patient's cousin says, I know that X treatment is being used in New York. I want you to use this for my cousin who is sick, who is on the ventilator, and so on. So, my question to you, is this A, prohibited, B, permitted, or C, obligatory for the doctor to actually prescribe this particular medicine, this particular treatment? Let me refine the question. Not only is it that this is a treatment that is not currently the norm, that is not currently standard of care here in Toronto, let's say it's a treatment that has not undergone testing. It's maybe in preliminary testing phases. Is the doctor allowed? Is the doctor required? Is the doctor prohibited from doing this? Who would like to tell me that the doctor is prohibited from using a treatment that has yet to pass clinical trials? That if you haven't yet proven its efficacy in clinical trials, you're not allowed to prescribe it? Anyone want to make that argument? Yes.
You're breaking up on the one that is that my iPad or everybody's PC?
Right. So the answer is I was getting a message that it was that there were problems, but it on my end it looks like it cleared up. I don't know. Is it still a problem?
No, now I can hear you fine, but the moment's there.
Yeah.
The voice coming through.
Yeah. No. No problem. Can anybody make an argument for saying that using a treatment that has yet to undergo full clinical trials is prohibited, that the doctor is not allowed to use this? Can anyone make that argument from a Jewish law perspective, that you shouldn't be allowed to use such a treatment? As a doctor's lawyer, Paul Herbert says no. Not as the doctor's rabbi, as the doctor's lawyer, let's be clear. Okay. Well, look, liability is liability. This is certainly true. From a Jewish law perspective, can anyone make the argument that you should not be allowed to use the treatment? So I have a message on the chat. Someone asks, what's the patient's prognosis if nothing is done? And the answer, of course, is we don't know. Meaning, I'll give you a case in which the patient is already on a ventilator, which we know, unfortunately, already means that things aren't looking great. On the other hand, it could be that in the course of treatment, many patients, thank God, have come off ventilators and have in fact recovered and left the hospital. My wife has a cousin who is, I think, released from the hospital as of today. So it can and does happen that people do get better and do end up leaving the hospital without these treatments.
Rabbi Dorchiner?
Yes, Jeff.
So if you're saying you want to propose a treatment that has not been subjected to a clinical trial, so how do you explain to the patient what the drug is supposed to do, let alone get what we would now consider to be true informed consent when we don't really know what the effect is going to be, as well as the risks and the deleterious effect of the interactions and so forth.
Right. So I'm going to come back to the informed consent question shortly. I'm not quite there yet, but I think it's a very important question, the issue of informed consent. But yes, it is very hard to even know, since you're dealing with a treatment that has not yet undergone testing, to know what it is that you're promising, what it is that you're trying, would seem to be rather challenging. Let me go the other way. Can anybody make an argument that the doctor is required to try this experimental treatment or this unproven treatment? Okay. Yeah.
If the patient is expected to not survive without any intervention, and there's a reasonable chance that the drug will improve the outcome, then is there a requirement to recommend it or to initiate that treatment?
Right. So that's definitely one of the questions we have to ask here is what's the status of the patient without this and what's the risk versus the reward. So let me take us through this step by step. Oh, I see a hand raised. Okay. Gershon.
David,
yes.
Not my field of expertise. I would defer to Herbert, but if it gives a treatment, shouldn't be a pretty reasonable physician would do. So the doctor's going to stick out his neck, and he better tell the patient because he's in a lot of trouble on a negligence suit or a malpractice suit. But I mean, not my field, so
right.
Yeah, I'll defer to Paul.
Right. So the legal standard of what a reasonable physician would do, I think, is going to become important. We are going to we're going to come back to this. I have a note in the chat referring to something that I am not familiar with, but I'm going to read it out and ask if someone, perhaps the person who posted it or somebody in general, could actually tell me what this is. Remember the Zamboni surgery for multiple sclerosis? Turned out to be a hoax, but patients demanded it and demanded payment from the government for obtaining it in the United States. What is the Zamboni surgery? I'm not familiar with that.
I think that was intended to increase venous return mm-hmm. to the something to do with circulation, the venous circulation to or from the brain, which was thought to improve MS.
Interesting. How long ago was this?
Like within the last 2 or 3 years.
Really? Okay, I'm not familiar. I have to read up.
I have to check Dr. Google and I'll get back to you.
There you go, thank you. Okay, so the first point that I'm going to make when it comes to using these treatments is that yes, informed consent is going to be required, and all the halachic authorities who deal with this question, those who dealt with it before the pandemic and those who have dealt with it in the last few weeks as it has come up in the pandemic, and specifically Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg in Israel, Rabbi Asher Weiss in Israel, they have stressed that the patient has to be aware of whatever the current information is. Granted that that information is incomplete, we don't know as much as we would like to know to be able to speak to the effectiveness of the treatment, the risk of the treatment, but whatever information is at our disposal has to be provided. Now, on your sheet, I noted for you a link to a class of mine on informed consent. Informed consent is really challenging. It's not as simple and straightforward as it's made out to be. It isn't as though doctor walks into the patient's room, gives a little speech about the risks and rewards and whatever, and then the patient is now able to, you know, as an expert, make a decision on whether to pursue treatment or not to pursue treatment. Life doesn't work that way. The patient is personally ill. Hang on 1 second. I know my speaker is giving trouble. Okay, good. So that's medical treatment for my computer. The challenge for the patient to, under great stress, when the patient is ill, make some kind of decision based on the information shared by the doctor is unrealistic. So much so that there are actually ethicists who argue that informed consent runs against the best interests of the patient. The patient will be better off having the medical professional be the one to make this decision because they understand the information and they're not the ones who are personally facing the situation. I know that in our culture of patient autonomy, that is never going to happen. That's not a policy that's going to fly. Nonetheless, I think it's important to recognize that, this idea of informed consent is not all it's cracked up to be. But let's say we've got that version of consent. You told the patient whatever the patient needs to know. The patient says, yes, I want this treatment. How do you decide whether to offer it? So I'm going to float three questions that the doctor needs to ask. And I actually sent this question to Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg and through a friend to Rav Asher Weiss. Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, for those who are not aware, is a pediatric neurologist at, Shari Tzedek. At Shari Tzedek in Israel. He actually was in Toronto in February, comes to Canada, speaks at the Torah in Motion medical programs, and is a world-class expert on Torah and especially medical halacha. And Rabbi Asher Weiss is also a leading posek, a leading halachic authority who speaks especially on medical halacha and is, I believe, the posek, the halachic authority for Shari Tzedek Hospital. So the two of them both have addressed this question recently. So three questions that have to be asked. Question number one, is there a major medical need for effective treatment? Is there really a sense that this is something that is a necessity for the sake of the patient? Because we know, we're taught in the Torah you have to guard your life. We are taught in the Gemara you're not allowed to do things that harm yourself. You need to be able to override those concerns which are relevant when you're dealing with an unproven treatment that may well turn out to be harmful. So how do you reach that stage where you say this is worth the risk? Well, you need to know that there's a great level of harm involved. Rabbi Dr. Steinberg made this point in an email exchange that I had with him. I sent him the question about a doctor using these treatments, which have not yet been proven, and we went back and forth a little bit, and he said that if you're dealing with a patient for whom the expectation is that the patient is likely to recover, the patient is not from a population that is considered to be that vulnerable, then you're not able to use an unproven treatment. However, if you're dealing with somebody who's in a vulnerable population or someone whose condition, as best as we can tell, is in greater danger, then you're justified in using this. I'll offer you a very interesting side note that came up from Rav Asher Weiss, and here I'm going to share the screen and hope it doesn't garble my audio. So we'll see how this goes. But I want to show you this piece from Rav Asher Weiss in source number one on the sheet. Rav Asher Weiss has put out now two compilations of his writings regarding the pandemic. He had one edition, then he had a second edition. In the second edition, his fifth responsum is addressed to a friend of mine, Rabbi Jason Wiener, who conveyed my question to him about the unproven medicines. And he deals in this piece not only with unproven medicines, but also with Rabbi Wiener's own question, which was, what about a vaccine? What about specifically a vaccine trial? You've probably read about it. I assume you've read about it. How people are volunteering to be injected with a trial vaccine and exposed to the coronavirus to see whether they're going to catch it or not. So Rabbi Asher Weiss speaks about this. And take a look at what he writes in source number one. This is his Hebrew in my translation. I'm going to read out my translation. He says, still it appears that this is so, meaning that one is able to volunteer for this, even in our case, that as long as it benefits the community, it is appropriate for a group of people whose heart moves them to volunteer for roles involving some danger. If you are trying to save large populations, this is a time of pandemic, you're able to volunteer for it because there's a major medical need on behalf of the community. Now, he assumes you're talking about people who are not themselves in high-risk populations, people who are otherwise in good health, but he's willing to call that major medical need to justify volunteering to endanger oneself by getting the by being exposed to the virus. He also mentions that Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach had a response to him that he refers to regarding this, you know, going back a few decades ago. So the first point that we make is, in order to be justified in using such a treatment, you need to have a major medical need, whether for the patient personally or, in Rav Asher Weiss's case, in for the community as a whole if you're dealing with some kind of a trial. Number two, you need to have an objective reason to think that this treatment is going to work. Now, I recognize that that's a little bit hard to say, but nonetheless, you need an objective reason to think this is going to work. Remember that that we are taught in the Torah that you have an obligation to try to help people, right? We're talking, again, from the perspective of the medical practitioner. So you have an obligation to help people. V'lo samol adam re'echa, don't stand by while someone's blood is shed. V'haftal re'echa kamocha, love your neighbor as yourself. V'rapo yirape, the practice of healing. So medical professionals are licensed and indeed obligated to use treatments for patients, assuming that there's real reason to think that they would that those treatments would work. And here I point you to source number two on the sheet. This is from Ramban, Rabbi Moses Nachmanides. He's addressing a classic question. The Torah says that in the event that one person attacks somebody else, that attacker is responsible for all sorts of payments to the victim. One of the payments that the attacker is responsible for is medical bills. They're responsible to pay the medical bills of the patient. V'rapo yirape, and he shall heal the patient. Says the Talmud, oh, that means that there must be such a thing as a doctor. The Torah must recognize doctors. Otherwise, why are you requiring someone to pay medical bills? However, Ramban is bothered, as everyone is bothered. Why do I need a biblical verse to teach me that you're allowed to heal people? That doesn't make any sense. Since I have an obligation to help people, of course I have an obligation to heal. Why do I need a verse for the Talmud to deduce that you heal people? And Ramban, right, Moses Nachmanides explains, and there's a similar note in source number three from Ruf Cook, that this is an issue of liability. You know, when I switch to share screen, I can only see a few faces at a time. But I've got two lawyers on my screen of the among the faces that I am able to see. I've got two lawyers here. I'll leave you to guess who they are. But this is a liability issue. Ramban Nachmanides in source number two says a doctor is like a judge who is commanded to judge. He has to try to heal. If he errs due to lack of knowledge, he has no punishment. Meaning, if there's a situation where he couldn't have done any differently, there was information that just wasn't known, but he acted based on his training, there's no liability. He quotes you the passage from the Talmud, a judge only has that which his eyes see. That's what you go on. And yet, where he errs and it becomes known to the court, he has to pay. There's a longer discussion. I'm not actually going to go into Ramban's comment here in number two, because it ends up being more complicated than I think is appropriate right now. I'm going to give you Rabbi Cook's version of it in number three. He says, the simple explanation of the words of the sages, and he shall heal, from this we see that the Torah permitted a doctor to heal, indicates that the knowledge involved in medicine is uncertain. Were it clear, how could anyone think there was no obligation to heal? would one not be violating, do not stand by the blood of another, for not intervening to prevent any trouble which befell a person, even trouble from heaven. Even a lion is from heaven, and yet we're instructed to save people from lions. You don't say, well, who am I to stop the lion? So too in medical treatment, Rabbi Cook's point, echoing that of Ramban, is that, yes, medical professionals are called upon to heal people using the best knowledge that they have. And if you'll tell me, but they're not perfect, they don't know everything, you do the best you can with the knowledge that you have. That's the idea. So, where the risk involved is relatively low, we're willing to trust the best knowledge that that medical professionals have. And in the event that you're talking about a situation like we're in right now, you don't just weigh the risk with this treatment, you weigh the risk versus the reward. So, in other words, as the danger that the patient is in goes up, the risk tolerance also goes up. They're in direct proportion. The greater the risk to the patient of not taking on this treatment, the greater the risk I'm willing to tolerate in giving this treatment. So what determines that a medicine is reliable? Well, there's a lot of overlap on this point between this discussion and the discussion we had last night about extending stay-at-home policies. We require that the treatment be as close as possible to what's called in Hebrew a refuah biduka, which means a tested medication, a tested act of healing. Rambam Maimonides, in the Mora Nevuchim, in the Guide of the Perplexed, says, and it's here in source number 4, he says, you can't just do random things. He says, you need to use something which either has been proven by experience or which has theory to support it. That's what we are looking for, says Rabbi Moses Maimonides. If you take a look at source number 5, Rabbi Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, we're moving forward in Jewish history, says, experience is a more honest witness than all the theories founded upon proofs. He says, don't give me your theories. Have you used it before? Has it worked? That's the question that he has. We're not going into a long discussion about alternative medicine right now, but those are the basic principles we're looking for to establish that a cure is, in fact, rifu'ah biduka, that it is tested. We want to have some experience, and some are willing to accept theory even where there is no experience. What else do we want? I go back to what we said last night. We want promotion by certified experts. You want people who are, yes, an establishment of sorts. I brought you the source that we saw last night from number 6, the Chida, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, quoting earlier sources, saying that that board certification qualifies to say, this is a person we trust. I actually wanted to revisit a point from last night, and I was looking to see if the person I discussed this with last night was on the call tonight, but I don't think I see him here. But I'm going to ask the question, or really discuss the question regardless, for those who are here. We talked about the problem of an establishment which doesn't know everything, and which, in fact, makes mistakes and hopefully acknowledges that they've made mistakes. They'll say, we should follow this procedure, and then it turns out that this procedure doesn't actually work. They say, well, this tack is not necessary, and then it turns out actually it was necessary. So, given the challenge of... the chat's a little distracting for me. So I saw a note in the chat. Somebody commented to me about AIDS patients in the 90s who were in such dire straits that they volunteered for very experimental cocktails that actually ultimately proved to be very effective. So that's an example of something that has a happy ending. Doesn't always have a happy ending. But to go back to what I was saying here, how long do you trust your board certified experts if they make mistakes? So I would note that there is certain tension in Judaism. On the one hand, Judaism has a tendency to trust authority and to trust government just because it is authority and just because it is government. Perhaps the best example of that, there's a biblical verse which says, "Vinasi ba'amacha lo ta'or." Do not curse a leader, a nasi. Do not curse a leader among your nation. The Sefer HaChinuch is a 13th century work that tries to explore each of the mitzvot and give a little bit of an explanation for each one. And on this mitzvah, the Sefer HaChinuch says, why is it that you should not curse the leader? Because you need leaders. And even if they're bad leaders, better a bad leader than no leader. Now, I can read the newspapers also and question that from time to time. Nonetheless, the basic idea is that you're better off having somebody in charge and making decisions and going with that policy than having anarchy and chaos. And that's one trend within Judaism. On the other hand, we have inherited a very rebellious DNA from our ancestors. And you can go all the way back to Abraham and Sarah and the rejection of the idolatry of Mesopotamia and Canaan. Or you can go all the way to the time of the prophets in the first temple, the first Beis HaMikdash, and you look at a Yeshaya, and you look at an Amos, and you look at a Yirmiyahu, and none of them seem particularly interested in accepting what the establishment has to say. So it's true that we have a tendency to support the certified authority, and it's also true that we have a tendency to reject it when we think we know better, or when we know better. Both sides are duly represented in our history. But it seems to me that the trend in halacha is to say, if someone has board certification, if someone has the majority on their side, which I'm going to come back to momentarily, that's the one we are more likely to follow. We also ask the question which the lawyers asked before, which is this the standard of care? Is this what people do? If you go with source number 7, Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, leading authority in medical halacha in Israel until he passed away about 15 years ago, he says, so long as, I'm jumping into the middle of the first line, so long as the doctor intends to heal via the medical methods he possesses, he is permitted to do so. And it is a mitzvah for him to treat the patient via, here are the key words, the accepted medical approach for this illness. What a reasonable doctor would do. The standard of care, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, also a leading authority at the end of the 20th century, said the same thing. Now, what do you do when experts disagree? What do you do when the standards clash with each other? So as I said last night, we try to get the greatest. Source number 8, Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch in the Code of Jewish Law, says you try to get the greatest doctor. We will work with a significant majority opinion, as I brought you in source number 9, we saw it last night. You want a recognizable majority. Rabbi Yaakov Reischer says he wants a two-thirds majority. What do you do, though, if you don't have the greatest available to consult? Well, you need to concede, and you go with whatever opinion you can get from the best possible authorities you can get. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg wrote, I brought it actually in source number 10, he said, as long as the greater doctor does not have the ability to treat every local patient, or the patient lacks the financial means of reaching him, any doctor with a diploma who has received certification and permission to treat professionally may treat, even though there's a greater doctor in the city. This is especially true for known illnesses with well-known and accepted modes of treatment. Then you need less expertise to be able to prescribe. But what we're saying here is this. We've raised two questions which have to be addressed. Number one, is there a major medical need for effective treatment? And is there an objective reason to think that this treatment will work? The last question of the three that you have to ask is, what about the fear of harm from treating this patient? So here we say, it's what I mentioned before about risk-reward. And our risk tolerance goes up as the danger to the patient goes up. Rabbi Herschel Schachter, in source number 11, was quoted. There. in an article called Preventive Medicine. Rehershel Schefter explains that when one's risk of developing disease is a mi'ud hamatsui, small yet recognizable risk, one will be obligated to undergo the appropriate testing for the disease. Rav Schefter suggests that a mi'ud hamatsui is in the range of 10%. Thus, if a person's risk were in the range of 10%, he will be obligated to be vaccinated. Now, I'm leaving that point about the vaccine and that aside, because the footnote is really what I wanted to see. He, Rabbi Schefter, asserted that if the adverse reaction risk for a given vaccine was in the range of 1 in a million, okay, the doctors acknowledge that 1 in a million will be harmed by this, the concept of batla daito etzel kol adam would be applied. Batla daito etzel kol adam means, I don't care what this person says because we go with what most people think. So he says, if the risk is 1 in a million, but this guy says, I am scared because you're doing this on 10 million people, and therefore 10 people could be hurt, and maybe I'm going to be one of them, we would say no. Batla daito. His opinion in this case is not considered halachically significant to mitigate an individual's fear which might have prevented him from being vaccinated. He's dealing, obviously, as you can see, with vaccines, but the same principle applies in general. Where the risk is low, and certainly where the risk is low relative to the harm, we're going to pursue the treatment. Now, I should note one caveat here, which is, this is all well and good when you're talking about the risk to this patient of the disease and the risk to this patient of taking the medication. But what about where pursuing this medication is going to put someone else at risk? I mentioned before the hydroxychloroquine and the concern that if people are going to take it for COVID-19, it isn't available for lupus, it isn't available for rheumatoid arthritis. So you do have to think very carefully there about the potential harm. However, if this is about saving the life of the patient in front of me, I am going to say, like we said last night, the patient in front of me is the one who has the greatest claim on my resources, and therefore I'm likely to say, go for it and use it, and don't worry about somebody else who may need it, like the city with the water supply. So to conclude the thought regarding the medical practitioner, I will go back to Rabbi Dr. Steinberg in the email exchange that I had with him. He felt that in a time of pandemic, where the patient's life is in danger, and the risk involved with the treatment is less than the risk from the illness, then take this treatment. And don't worry about the normal rules for trying medications and so on. He felt that for the patient, it's optional, but the doctor really should be proposing this. However, if the patient is asymptomatic, mildly symptomatic, not part of a population that is vulnerable, then he felt you don't use it. Clear so far? I have one piece left on the patient's perspective, but I just wanted to make sure that we're clear so far. Okay. So from the point of view of the patient, now we've reached a stage where the medical professional says, all right, I went to the shiur, I understand, I am now prescribing this treatment. Is the patient required to take it? Well, if the treatment has a great likelihood of working and very low risk involved, then it becomes obligatory. Right? Leaving aside the issue of compelling patients to pursue treatments they don't want, I'm not getting into that. I'm certainly not getting into assisted death and so on and so forth. That's not our discussion tonight. We have enough to deal with. But what I do want to talk about here is, what is the duty of the patient where things are less clear? What about where there's a possibility it could work, but there's also a risk? I'm going to come back again to the hydroxychloroquine, because it's such a perfect example, so much has been written about it, where we're told that there are risks to the patient's heart, as an example. It's not a situation of either it will work or it won't work. There actually is potential fallout for the health of the patient. So the greater the risk, the more this becomes optional rather than obligatory. And of course, if the risk reaches a certain threshold, then we say, no, you're not allowed to engage in it. But if the need for this treatment is low, then we say that it becomes optional. If the patient has an objective reason to think that the doctor does not know whether to use it or not, the patient has reason to doubt. Take a look, please, at source number 12. Rabbi Yaakov Emden, in his Moruk Tziyah comments to the Torah, says, with an illness or a visible wound for which a doctor has certain knowledge and clear understanding and he prescribes a tested complete treatment, we certainly compel a recalcitrant patient if the alternative would be dangerous. He says, where the doctor knows what he's doing, the doctor has clear knowledge, and the patient says, I don't want to do it. Well, if the alternative is dangerous, we're going to tell the patient, I'm sorry, you need to pursue this treatment. But the opposite, then, is also true, which is where the doctor does not have what Rabbi Emden calls certain knowledge and clear understanding, then it's less clear that the patient has any obligation to go through with this. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein in the 20th century said the same thing in source number 13 when you're talking about a treatment that is itself dangerous. He said it's logical to say that when most patients live via this treatment, he's obligated to undergo the treatment. But if the odds are even, then it's logical to say we should not obligate the patient. If he is concerned for his definite short-term life, he says, you know what, right now I'm doing well, I don't want to take this and end my life. He doesn't want to enter into possibly losing that life for the possibility of gaining more time. He certainly is licensed. The patient's allowed to say, I don't necessarily want to pursue this treatment. So what we're saying is, if the need is low, or if the patient has objective reason to think that maybe the doctor's advice is incorrect, or if the doctor acknowledges that this is a dangerous treatment, then we back off. The patient is entitled to decline it. Last note, what if the patient wants the treatment and the medical professional thinks that it's not indicated or it's even potentially harmful? The patient says, I heard about such and such. I want you to give me this treatment. And the doctor says, I think this is a terrible idea. So if you take a look at source number 14, Rabbi Avram Gambiner in the 17th century says, listen to the doctor. If the patient says, I need this medicine, and the doctor says, you don't need that, then we listen to the patient. If the doctor says the medicine would harm him, we listen to the doctor. If the doctor just says it's unnecessary, go with what the patient says. If the doctor thinks it's harmful, then no, we're not interested in listening to the patient. Now, footnote to that discussion. Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham was the head of internal medicine, an internal medicine unit at Shaare Tzedek Hospital for decades. And he wrote the Nishmas Avram, which is a landmark work on medical halacha. It's really a fantastic work. Actually, we had a class for 2 years at Shaare Shemayim. We had a weekly class on the Nishmas Avram. So Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham deals with this question of what do you do when the patient says, I want. And it's very clear that there's a difference between the historic world of patient and doctor relationships and what goes on today. Meaning, historically, there was a concept of the patient knows what his needs are. Medicine was not at that level of sophistication where there were theories which required training in order to grasp them. It was, I feel like I am hungry. You know, I need to eat something, and that's why I am ill, because I haven't eaten something. So you could accept the patient's word. However, when medicine became more sophisticated, this view that where the doctor thinks it's unnecessary, give it to the patient anyway, starts to recede. Or to quote Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, we don't rely on quacks even if they are popularly accepted, was his phrase that he used in the email to me. If the patient says, well, I think I need this, but it's not based on medical science, it's just based on, you know, I saw something on the news, then the doctor is not obligated by the Magen Avram to listen to the patient. And certainly where the doctor thinks it's harmful for the patient, the doctor has no business listening to the patient and prescribing it. So hopefully that gives us some sense of the discussion on this and the tensions that that exist in Jewish law. Are there questions? Okay. Well, then thank you very, very much. Yeah.
One quick question.
Yeah.